Sherab Lama was a young Tibetan exile back in the mid-70s. He and his friend were filled with patriotism, willing to do anything to fight for Tibet's independence. What's more, they got themselves an interview with Tibet's spiritual leader in exile, the Dalai Lama. Sherab says they were both in awe of the man. They prostrated themselves on the floor of his office. And then the Dalai Lama himself stood up.
He walked from his chair and he said, "Yeah, okay, okay," and told us to sit down. And there's a couch. Of course, we didn't dare to sit on the couch. And we sat near at his feet. And literally what he says, "What's up?" Which made, like, immediately cleared all our fear.
That question from the Dalai Lama, that "what's up," led to an hour-long conversation with the man who's now one of the greatest living proponents of nonviolent resistance. It is a creed that's being tested today in Tibet. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
It's been over 50 years since the worst of China's crackdowns on Tibetans. That's why the outburst of street fighting in Tibet's capital Lhasa this past week caught everyone, including Chinese authorities, off guard.
Monks and ordinary Tibetans vent their anger on the streets of Lhasa. The government has flooded this province with Chinese settlers to keep control. When that iron grip slipped, some Tibetans attacked their Chinese neighbours, chasing them through the city's streets. For once, government security forces were nowhere to be seen.
But since that initial outbreak, Chinese forces are reported to have moved in with a vengeance. As many as 100 Tibetans have been killed, maybe more. No one knows.
Shame on China!
Shame on China!
Protesters calling shame on China have been marching in cities from D.C. to New Delhi. And today, as so often in years past, Tibet is locked down. Sherab Lama has family there, but he has no idea who's safe and who's not.
I don't know. No way of knowing, especially those in Lhasa.
What's that like?
I think I could say a very similar situation like when they hijacked the plane from New York to hijack.
You're talking about 9/11.
9/11, exactly. I would say a feeling of a family member of a hijacked plane in 9/11. For me, I'm watching. My feeling is like I'm on the family member on the ground who don't know. I pray this plane would be landed safely. But the people in there have the same feeling as the passenger in the plane, especially when the passengers know that this is not a simple hijacking. They're going to die within minutes.
The trouble, says Sherab, is that China has the ability to monitor all communication in and out of Tibet. Cell phones, computers, email, none of it's safe. He doesn't dare to even try to contact his brother.
Every time somebody receives that email, it's processed.
By processed, you mean someone in China reads it?
Someone in China reads it, and if they get a slightest idea that there is a different meaning in this, especially about politics, they put a separate file. And that person, within 48 hours, will be questioned.
What do you mean by question? Someone will call them on the telephone?
Not in a telephone call. It's always somebody in uniform who will be in front of your door. It always means like something serious.
Last night, for example, was the deadline for people in Tibet who were reported to have taken part in the Tibetan protests. It was the deadline for them to turn themselves into the police. Sherab Lama says he believes that the Chinese soldiers will use the same tactics they've used in the past, going door to door and insulting the revered Dalai Lama just to see if they can get a reaction.
So they would ask something like that. You know, the Dalai Lama, he's a crooked politician in a monk dress.
So the Chinese purposely slander the Dalai Lama.
Absolutely. That slander will bring them. So when they say, "Do you agree to this?" That's how they see whether this person has participated or not. And if you don't say that, they say, "Okay, we'll go to the next stage." We have been hearing news. In Tibetan, we have different way of communication. I heard from my relatives and friends in Nepal and other areas saying the buzzards, you call it?
Buzzards?
The turkey buzzards.
The vultures?
The vultures.
Yeah.
Above Lhasa has blanketed the sky of Lhasa. That many people has been killed. If the person is really standing hard to his principles, he'll be executed.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Shirab Lama says there was a time when he was ready to lay down his life, to use violence in the fight for Tibet's independence. He'd been raised in a refugee camp with other Tibetan exiles. He went to college in India. And back in the 1970s, when he and a friend had these strong ideas about an armed struggle, they requested a meeting with the man Shirab calls His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. And to their great surprise and delight, he agreed to meet them. So the two young men traveled to Dharamsala, the home of Tibet's government in exile in northern India.
And the word from the His Holiness office is, we'll call you.
So you wait.
Yeah, and come at that time. So it was, I remember very clearly, it is January 5th, 1977. My friend and I were staying in the Tibetan children's village. And, you know, in Dharamsala, you can't have hot shower just like running hot water. You have to make hot water. So we were thinking, well, today may be the day, you know, that we will be cold. So we decided to take a hot shower and get ready, you know, tighten ourselves a little bit. And as we were putting hot water,
boiling the water,
boiler, you know, his sister was frantic calling us, you got to go.
You have to go see the Dalai Lama now.
They called. And we were literally in our pajamas. So we came down, and she threw to us two traditional dress we call chuba, ropes. And we carried it, and the place from the Tibetan children's village to His Holiness residence is like a good hour walk, normal. I remember the time also, she told us it's going to be at 8, and we have only 20 minutes. And so we ran, we dashed. And when we got at the gate of His Holiness residence, the Indian security man said, slow down. Probably he knows how many people get excited at the gate.
He's seen this
before.
Yeah,
he said, slow down. And then I think he informed someone. So one of the staff members from His Holiness office came down. I said, okay, you two are this. And we say, yes, sir. And they say, okay, cool down and calm down. There's plenty of time. It's a monk, a geshe. So the monk told us, change your dress. Wear your chuba, the national dress, and comb your hair. So we have, of course, no comb. So we did freshen up a bit. And then he took us to the inner compound of His Holiness. And he said, we wait here. So as we were waiting, we were so nervous. I asked my friend, what the heck did we ask for nowadays?
Why are we here?
Yeah, why are we here? You know, so we were nervous, and he said, okay, he has much calmer disposition. So he said, let's jot down what we need to say to His Holiness.
You hadn't written anything down?
We haven't written anything down. So we wrote, you know, in Tibetan, what our inspiration is, how much, you know, we want to do, and all this.
Now, what you're doing at this point is writing down things that you think you can do to help free Tibet? Is that what you're thinking?
About freeing Tibet, about how we want to serve, how willing we are willing to serve.
And you have a lot of passion?
Oh, we are burning. I mean, when we finish college and wanting to serve in Dharamsala, we are not thinking about the salary. We are not thinking about the job position.
What is it that you are thinking about?
We were brought up and educated to take the cause of Tibet and Tibetans into the next generation's direction. So we are educated, and we have to utilize our education to improve it, to develop it.
But what are the ways that you think you can do this? Are you thinking that, for example, that you'll use violence, that you would agree to use violence to help Tibet?
We will also have that in notion in our head. Especially, you know, those were the years when there was Olympic in Germany and others, and Palestinians and Israel.
Oh, all the hijacked planes in the 1970s.
Planes.
You're ready to hijack a plane for Tibet?
We talked, actually, I and my friends, we talked a lot, and we knew we can. We really can.
You were ready to do this?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
As Sherab Lama was explaining to me, the two young men had spelled out in a small note all their ideas about the value of an armed struggle, and they were ready to give that to the Dalai Lama. However, the first thing they did when they entered the leader's office was stretch out on the floor in front of him.
And when we, got in very nervous from the door, and did our prostration, a Buddhist way of showing our respect, body, speech, mind, humbling ourselves in front of a teacher, spiritual teacher. And he walked from his chair and he said, okay, and told us to sit down. And there's a couch. Of course, we didn't dare to sit on the couch. And we sat near at his feet.
On the floor.
Yeah, and literally, I don't remember exact word, but what he says, what's up?
And he's a young man at this point. He's just about 40 years
old,
right?
Yeah, 40-something.
Yeah, okay.
And he sat back on his chair and looked to the ceiling and he said, what's up? Something like that, which made, immediately cleared all our fear.
You relaxed.
Oh, completely, his honest is cool.
So now Sherab Lama and his friend, the other young Tibetan exile, are settling in with their spiritual leader, a man they've now concluded is cool. And they're ready to make their case to the Dalai Lama that it may be time to take up arms to defend Tibet. Well, we'll hear what his reaction was in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The latest news on the clashes in Tibet is coming today from China, and it's coming in the form of a direct accusation from China's premier, Wen Jiabao. Here's a translation of what he's saying.
We have ample evidence to prove that this incident was organized, premeditated, and masterminded by the Dalai clique. This has all the more revealed that the consistent claims by the Dalai clique that they pursue not independence but peaceful dialogue are nothing but lies.
It is an odd accusation, given that the Dalai Lama is one man who's been determined all his life that the only route to a future for Tibet is through nonviolence. This is a lesson that Sherab Lama learned 30 years ago. Sherab is also a Tibetan exile. In 1977, he and a friend from college had their own personal audience with the Dalai Lama. They'd gone to see him with ideas of using violence, an armed struggle, hijacking planes, whatever it took. And they'd written their little manifesto down. Sherab's friend was trying to read it to the Dalai Lama.
It was in my friend's hand. And he was looking and, with a little bit of shaky hand and trying to say our point. And His Holiness said, give me that note.
Give me the piece of paper.
Yeah, give it to me. And he looked and he said, there's a spelling mistake. the Tibetan word for exile was misspelled with a vowel. He corrected. He said, this, and he made a joke about it, saying, if you use this vowel, it means a different indication or something.
Well, he's a teacher, right?
Yeah, he's a teacher. And so we felt, completely relaxed, calm. And then he looked and he said, well, this not good notion when he read the part when we said we are willing to give our life, in
he said he disagreed with that.
Yeah, then he asked us to elaborate.
He asked you to explain what you were thinking.
So, we couldn't say much. We were nervous to say. Then he said, okay. Then he gave us a talk on what violence leads to. We were officially to have 10 minutes audience with him to show our certificates and get his blessing and come out. And he gave us more than 1 hour.
You and your friend and the Dalai Lama together for 1 hour?
More than an hour. because His Holiness was giving us advice.
What did he tell you, Sheriff?
At that time, my friend was Buddhist, I would say. I was really least Buddhist. I don't believe much about this. But that quotation, I memorized. He said a word like in English, roughly translated, is a verse. Commit not an unwholesome deed, but gather a wealth of virtue. Okay. Subdue your mind to its entirety, for this is the teaching of the Buddha. I thought like, wow, I don't want any way of going Buddha way. You know?
Yeah.
Subduing your mind. Oh yeah. But that I jotted down, and then it has been ever with me.
What did he say about your ideas of violence?
So on that, that's why on this context, on this verse context, he said, first of all, you guys have to be a good human. He said, it is disturbing for me sometimes to hear Tibetan youngsters telling lies, doing something against the law, violence in the cities of India. It is very disturbing. It is very shameful. That's what he told us. Do not do that.
No use of violence.
Yeah, no use of violence. He said, what we are known for is nonviolence. What Tibet has lived for and proud for is nonviolence. So he literally, what he was saying is, get rid of that excitement out of your head and come down to earth.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to the story of how two young Tibetans got their personal lesson in nonviolence directly from the Dalai Lama. After the meeting, Sherab Lama and his friend were headed back into the city and talking about what they'd just heard.
We knew the way His Holiness tells us goes deep in our mind, in our heart.
So he changes your way of thinking?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Because we respect him in such level that a single word from him came out from him has the best intention. So when he says no violence, though at the beginning it's like, all right, you know, you're a monk, but we have to ponder it because his intention is always for benefit. We were burning with the desire for freedom and gaining independence. At the same time, we are really shocked how neglected we are by the world.
Nobody's paying attention to
Tibet. Nobody's paying attention.
Yeah.
Nobody about the nonviolence. Nonviolence is boring. Yeah, anything you read and when you see about the Middle East problems and Palestine, and Israel's and hijackings, and you say, well, this is the atmosphere we got to get in. That's life. That's what we got to do.
Let's blow stuff up.
Yeah,
let's get back in the newspapers.
Absolutely. We have to get the attention like this.
And but the Dalai Lama changed your mind about that, right?
Absolutely.
30 years ago. My question for you is, do you ever doubt that? Do you ever think to yourself, oh, maybe if we made a bigger noise, maybe if we tried to fight the Chinese in the streets, maybe if we did at least fight back, you know, people would pay attention. Did you ever think that?
No, because as years pass by, the advice His Holiness has given to us, to every Tibetan, start making much more meaning. I suppose that as we get more mature and see the real reality of life.
As you get older and wiser.
And the value for human lives.
Yeah.
No, I mean, thank God, we, in 77, we followed him blindly because we trust him. And later, then yes. It making much more sense, much more sense. And now my generation is the parent of the younger generation who are going on the streets. Then we tell them. And they realize they had the same same hot head.
That you did when you were young.
That we did in the 70s. So we can understand fully their frustration.
And that is Sherab Lama's own theory about the current violence in Tibet. He says this younger generation of monks and citizens is now questioning the value of nonviolence. And he says there's so much tension inside Tibet right now that anything can touch off a confrontation.
Some monks feel nervous. Some people feel nervous. I mean, they're curious too. As we in Tibetan say, without the head, they use the hand first. And there is set the fire. And then people are emotional. People know something is happening. Just not very deep in their head is always a revolution, always a, suppressed thought that they want to express. So it led, and people set cars on fire. People set stores, especially those belongs to Chinese, on fire. And this is exactly what the Beijing want.
This is what Beijing wants, to have a confrontation.
But maybe not at this time. But this is exactly what they always look.
Because that gives them the excuse to crack down?
This gives them then to crack down, do the silent slaughter.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Sherab Lama now sells Himalayan goods from a shop in Raleigh, North Carolina. His job takes him back to Nepal, even into Tibet. But this past summer, for the first time in years, he was turned away at the Tibetan border. The Chinese border guards were very clear.
What they say, they told me, is anybody, no matter what passport they are bringing in, holding, anybody who has a Tibetan name should not be allowed in, especially in so-called the autonomous region of Tibet.
So Sherab Lama is a Tibetan name.
Yeah.
And
no.
No way you were going to get in because of your name.
Yeah, even if I would be carrying a diplomatic passport of the United States, they would say, no, not this guy. Yeah, so that really reflected to me, like, why they are going so serious.
Did you think last summer that maybe things are starting to change for the worse?
I thought it's changing, it will be very tense and sensitive till the Olympics is over.
And we're seeing that now.
And we are seeing that over, and now it is spreading. The fire is spreading almost uncontrollable. See, this is how always Beijing goes wrong. Because this is what His Holiness just a few days said, like, how can you control people with force? Now this is a chain of reaction. Every Tibetan heart is burning with some, has tolerated so much for the last 50 years that it has really little space to still bring down your temperature.
You're listening to The Story. Sherab Lama is a Tibetan exile. His family was forced to leave Tibet 50 years ago when he was just a baby. In recent years, Sherab's been able to return a number of times. He has seen the way that Tibetans resist Chinese control, and he says watching that, he's learned that it can be done in a nonviolent and a subtle way. He told me about one moment, 15 years ago. He was in the capital city, Lhasa, at the bus stop.
I was waiting for a bus to go from Lhasa city to a place called Tolung. So there's this, Toyota minibus. And they would say, Tolung, Tolung. I was waiting, and there was several other people waiting. And this quite new bus, minibus, came. And as the bus stopped, I was going to get in. And the lady behind me, a very typical Lhasa lady, with a straw hat and, with pink cheeks and all that, pulled me back. I thought, what's doing,
This is the bus to Tolung. Why can't I get on?
So I looked back to her, and she said, don't you see? I said, what's he? That's a Chinese bus. And then she can realize that I'm being really innocent. And she said, wait, the next Tibetan bus will come.
And what is she saying, Sherab? That she doesn't, that you'll be in danger if you get
on
the bus?
No. What is she saying in Lhasa, the silent movement, as I was saying, is that the people are so united and they have their own unique ways of saying we don't want, we are suppressed.
So what was she saying to you?
So she was saying is don't get into that bus that belongs to Chinese business. The driver is a Chinese, so it belongs to a Chinese businessman. but they write the one that will come, which belongs to a Tibetan businessman and driven by a Tibetan. And it's true, after 10 minutes came one, which is older and is crowded.
And probably not as safe.
Yeah, it's so crowded, forget our seat.
Yeah.
You know, you can hardly put your hand up there on the bar. And she said, now get in, this is the last bus.
Because it's a Tibetan
yeah,
bus.
Yeah, it's Tibetan. And full of, you know, the bus was like overloaded. And, you know, things like that make me learn in Tibet how things are going.
Sherab Lama says he's convinced that a part of the push for nonviolence involves people who are not Tibetan, and that if people in the rest of the world took the time to criticize Chinese repression in Tibet, that it would make a difference.
If the general American people, or any really who has a good heart and feeling the emotion that this is wrong, writes saying, stop this, just one sentence, stop this, you know, or you can say more stronger in the sense, stop this culture genocide now. To their leaders, Congress leaders or senators, and to the Chinese embassies, I think if this really goes and supported like this, we can see Tibet.
So when I ask you if you'll see a free Tibet in your lifetime, you say that doesn't really matter, right? It's not about when.
Yeah.
You have children?
Yeah, I have.
How old are they now?
One is college going, the other is high school.
But you must want them to see Tibet. You must want them to imagine a free Tibet.
Sure. I can take them physically to Tibet anytime.
Well, you couldn't get in last summer.
Yeah, but I think once the Olympics are over, it is possible to visit Tibet.
You can keep this country alive, is what you're saying to me?
Yeah, we can keep that country alive through our language and our culture. No matter where we are, I have to do it not forcefully, but through my way of life to my children so that they see. I mean, they will not see right now, and I know that, you know, a teenager do not care, as I didn't care.
Yeah. But do they speak Tibetan?
They speak Tibetan, and I try to send them into Dharamsala and others. I sent one to a nursery school to teach English. And then I'm thinking to send the younger one even to work as a volunteer in an old age home in Tibet. So if I can keep this, and though I see that probably my, you know, daughters will not listen to me or cannot because they are adjusted and different mentality, different competition of life, but once I have full confidence, once they come to my age, once they come to an age where they are parents, they realize this is important. And I think this is important for the country too.
So you're confident, even if the protests continue in Tibet, even if the Chinese continue to crack down, that Tibet will survive some way.
Yes. The spirit of Tibet, what is Tibet known is not really for the land. What is really known Tibet is because of its character.
Sherab Lama joined me here in our Chapel Hill studio. We have a photograph of Sherab from back in the 1970s, around the time when he met with the Dalai Lama. And we also have links to his nonprofit cultural organization on our website. You'll find all that at thestory.org. In just a moment, I'll take a trip with a seasoned news photographer back to the scene of one of the world's worst natural disasters in recent years, Peter Turnley, and his memory of the Armenian earthquake of 1988.
I had never seen at that point in my life an earthquake, and I didn't know what to expect. The landscape itself was very dramatic, very raw, rubble everywhere. Armenians are wonderful people. And they've had a really difficult history, and I feel like a lot of their history is seen in their eyes. Armenians, in my mind, have beautiful but very sad eyes. And so you add to that this backdrop of a disaster where overnight everything is flattened, life has stopped, almost everyone has lost a family member, and there's just drama everywhere.
Peter Turnley was a Newsweek photographer when he covered the Armenian earthquake back in 1988, and he'll join me in just a moment to talk about how his meeting with one elderly man in the scene of all that wreckage sticks with him today. That's up next. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. What we know about troubled parts of the world, whether it's Tibet or Darfur, usually comes to us through the work of journalists, correspondents, and photographers. I did this myself for a number of years. You hop on a plane at a moment's notice to get to a war zone or the scene of a natural disaster. Sometimes the work can affect you in ways that you might never anticipate. And that's where my next guest, Peter Turnley, comes in. Peter's been a photojournalist for 25 years. Back in 1988, he was shooting for Newsweek. Word came that Armenia, still then part of the Soviet Union, had been hit with a massive earthquake. As many as 50,000 people were feared dead. Peter asked the Soviet authorities if he could go, and he was shocked when they said yes.
My first reaction was incredible and great skepticism, because to that point, no Western journalist had ever been given access to this kind of major natural disaster in the Soviet Union.
But the permission was real. Peter soon found himself on a flight from Moscow to Yerevan, the capital of Armenia. It was a flight filled with Soviet soldiers.
And they all looked just incredibly anxious and nervous and unhappy. It was cold. It was wintertime. This was just before Christmas, 1988. And I even remember one of the soldiers actually lighting on the aisle floor of this flight a kerosene little stove to heat some food. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, we've got burning kerosene on this flight. And it was sort of a reflection of the anomalies that one encountered working there at that time.
Peter Turnley had never been to an earthquake zone at this point. He wasn't prepared for what he was going to see. He got on a bus filled with local people and yet more soldiers and headed to a nearby town called Spitak.
As we approached this town of Spitak, suddenly, as I looked out the window, it was like getting a bowling ball thrown into my stomach. I had the impression that I was looking at the result of a nuclear attack. Everywhere I looked, everything was flattened. There was rubble everywhere. Nothing stood. There were no buildings that were standing. And the bus pulled into a parking lot next to a stadium. And I got off this bus. And the first thing I did was to walk into the stadium, and there I saw a sight like I've almost never seen anywhere else. I have seen a lot, unfortunately, of death now around the world in the last 25 years, but that particular day, laying there on the turf of this stadium were literally thousands of dead bodies.
And this is an outdoor stadium, Peter.
Yes, it was an outdoor stadium, and there were many of them that were in open caskets, many of them just simply laying on the grass turf. And there were people walking from body to body trying to discover their family members. And occasionally you would see people finding family members and hitting the ground and breaking down crying. And there was just a ton of emotion. And it was just unbelievably raw because it was so cold and bodies were also in very bad condition, clothes were ripped, often bodies, members were torn apart, faces were disfigured. And I remember one of the things that I recall most vividly watching that scene of people looking for their family members was saying to myself, you know, not only do these poor people have to look for people that they love that are dead, but they also have to find them in these conditions. So I certainly made photographs of those scenes. And this was in some ways quite historic because it was probably the first time in my knowledge that Western journalists had ever seen anything like this in the Soviet Union, any kind of human tragedy of this order.
Because areas like that would be closed off, as the Soviet authorities would say, we're fine, we can handle it, it's not a problem, don't talk about it.
Absolutely. These kinds of events often were spoken of and reported in a sense with sort of statistics, but in the West, on the other side of the Iron Curtain, people almost never saw vivid imagery of these kinds of things, these realities in the Eastern Bloc, and certainly not in the Soviet Union.
Peter, how did you get around, though? I mean, if the place had been really that knocked apart, were there roads that you could drive on? Were there cars that you could hire? How did you work?
Well, very good question and an important question. In the earthquake area itself, there were simply no amenities at all. There was no food. There was almost no water, no fuel, no places to stay or sleep, certainly no restaurants, no telecommunications. You have to remember also, this was a time where there were no telephones. Back then, the only way that you could communicate in the best of times was by telex. And at this time, there were almost no telex machines operating. So really, one was just quite cut off. And the only way that one could get around was, the only way I could get around was by hiring local drivers. And I had gone very light. I had gone with essentially maybe one change of clothes and a camera bag and lots of film. And I really became quite lit up. I thought, you know, this is really important for everyone else, for the rest of the world, that I make use of this opportunity. I make some important pictures that communicate what people are feeling, how they're experiencing this. So for the next 10 days, day in, day out, I would commute between Yerevan and these two towns of Leninikon and Spitak.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Peter Turnley was working as a photojournalist for Newsweek magazine back in 1988. He was covering the earthquake that tore up Armenia at that time. One of the photos Peter took is on our website. You can see it at thestory.org. I should also mention that Peter has a twin brother named David, who's also a photojournalist.
As we all know in journalism, I mean, there's always the sense of either being early or late on a story, particularly if it's a big story.
Yeah.
And I've certainly in my career known both sentiments. I've been at both early and sometimes quite late. And I had a sense on this particular story, you know, I knew that I was one of the first Western journalists of any type to be in this area. There weren't a lot of people there. Little by little, 3, 4, 5 days as I was there, I would start to see more and more recognizable colleagues of all forms of media, television, radio, writers, photographers. Not many, but certainly little by little, a sort of trickle. Well, about the fourth day I was there, one day I was in this little town of Spitak, and I encountered a foreign correspondent. And he said to me, hey, how you doing? What'd you think of that scene in Leninikon yesterday? And I cracked up laughing because I was not in Leninikon the day before, and so I knew that my twin brother was in the area.
This happens periodically, I guess.
I was really kind of excited thinking, well, hey, Dave figured this one out. I knew that it was a tough morsel to crack, so I said to myself, somehow he figured out how to get from Paris to Yerevan in a pretty short period of time, and I had this sort of sense of pride, and I was glad that he was around. So about a day later, I found my brother, and we began to work with each other, and we would hire a car on a daily basis.
At the point when you hooked up with David, you'd been shooting there for 4 or 5 days. What were the pictures that you were taking? What were you seeing at that point?
The landscape itself was very dramatic, very raw, somewhat beautiful, mountainous, but a lot of snow, and then rubble everywhere. Armenians are wonderful people, and they've had a really difficult history. And I feel like a lot of their history is seen in their eyes. Armenians, in my mind, have beautiful but very sad eyes. And so you add to that this backdrop of a disaster where overnight everything is flattened, life has stopped, almost everyone has lost a family member, and there's just drama everywhere. People crying, screaming. Armenians are also a very very expressive in their emotions. Men cry quite easily with pride, and there's a real tremendous sense of community among Armenians. So I'm seeing this scene on a daily basis of just a rainbow of powerful human emotion. People were desperately looking for family members, hoping that they would find them under slabs of concrete, hoping that they would find live people. You would see scenes still after 4 or 5 days where people had lost their home and they would have found a family member, and they would have laid the body out on the sidewalk or on the street, and just keep constant day in, day out candle vigils for these family members, where they would sit around a fire and eat whatever small food they had in a kind of a sort of funeral-like memorial for their family members. So the scenes were very raw.
By the time that Peter Turnley hooked up with his twin brother David, he'd been in Armenia for 4 or 5 days. It was cold, he was exhausted, and yet the two of them knew that they had to keep taking pictures. They hired an old Soviet taxi. David got in the front, Peter in the back.
We started to drive towards Spitak on these very muddy, raw, pretty lousy roads. And before long, just on the outskirts of Leninikon, this major city, there was an elder man that was standing on the side of the road by himself, dressed in just a coat and a scarf. And he had his hand out hitchhiking. And so I told the driver, I asked him to stop to pick up this man. And so we stopped and we asked him where he was going. And he said he was going to Spitak, that he was from Spitak, and that he got into the car and he got quite emotional. And he said that he thanked us very much for picking him up. And he said he was going to the place where he had lived, that he had lost everything in his life. He'd lost his house, lost his wife and his children, but he wanted to go back and see where he had lived and just to be there. He needed to go and be there. And his story, as he told it, was already very hard to hear, very devastating. I felt tremendous sadness for this guy. And he was sitting right next to me. He was probably in his 60s. And he was kind of a very nice-looking man. He had a few days of unshaven beard. Armenian men and women are often very handsome. And he had this kind of rugged sort of handsomeness. But what struck me was that after he told his story and we continued on our way, which was going to take about an hour, and I was quite tired. I'd been working long hours, long days. It was really cold. And I started to sort of doze off. And at one point, as he saw me start to sort of doze off, he tugged on my coat, and I opened my eyes and I looked at him, and he motioned in this very kind of sort of fatherly way that I should put my head on his lap. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, what a sort of amazing, generous and tender gesture this was for a man that had lost everything. And, you know, this sort of gesture of kindness. And I actually, you know, I was a grown man at this point, but I allowed myself to accept his offer. And I recall laying my head down on his lap, and the car continued, and suddenly this man began to hum and to sing in Armenian, and he sang very beautifully. And as he did that, he started to stroke my hair with his hand. And rather than feeling uncomfortable, I remember thinking that the way that he was stroking my hair, he needed some connection to life, that he had just lost everything, and that that I represented some human connection to an existence and to something that felt like affection and maybe even love on some level. And I felt really honored.
My guest is the photojournalist Peter Turnley. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Peter's journey obviously didn't end there. He told me that the man they picked up in that taxi nearly 20 years ago changed his outlook on his profession and even of himself.
We finally arrived in this town, and we knew that we needed to get to work, but we wanted to make sure that this man got to where his house had been. And so we, through the driver, we asked him where he lived, and he told us where he lived, and we pulled up to this mound of rubble, concrete rubble, and the car doors opened and the man got out of his car. And I have to say it was probably about minus 5 degrees. It was incredibly cold. And the man got out of the car and he looked at this scene and he fell on the ground and he just started to sob and to pound the ground. He just started to hit with his fist the ground and sob and literally scream. And it was an agonizing scene to witness. And I remember just feeling this tremendous sense of desperate sadness for him. And this went on for about 5 minutes. And, you know, my brother and I decided that we should, you know, take our time and stay with him for a little while. And finally he stood up and he gathered himself and we looked at him and through the driver we said that we needed to go, that we had to get on our way, and that we felt so sorry for him and that it had been wonderful to meet him and that our hearts went out to him and we hoped that somehow he would find some peace and that things would be okay for him. And he came towards me and he opened his arms and he gave me a big hug and we hugged each other for quite a period of time. And here I was, a guy that, you know, was from America, that lived in Paris, a Western photojournalist. I wasn't dressed in any kind of fancy way, but I think I probably had a down coat on. And I certainly had no sense of my own discomfort. I knew that I was going to be able to leave this place, and if I was too cold or uncomfortable, I would eventually be able to get somewhere where it was warm, and I'd be eventually back home with my family. And as I said goodbye, the man had a wool scarf around his neck, and all he had in life that was left was a coat and a scarf, and maybe what was in his pockets, and that was all he had that was left in his life. And he took this scarf off, and he tried to wrap it around my neck, and he said through the translator, he said, "I want you to have this. You look like you're cold." And I just couldn't believe this gesture. I didn't accept the scarf. I said, I thanked him so much, and I put it back around his neck, and I said, "You need this. You need to stay warm." But that gesture has stayed with me all my life because I've seen a lot of human difficulty over the years now, and I've seen a lot of conflict. I've seen people do horrible things to each other. I've seen life and natural elements do horrible things to human beings. But in the midst of that, I also have had the incredible opportunity to witness some amazing gestures of decency and honesty and fairness and goodness. And it's been gestures like that man wanting to give me his scarf that have, to me, defined what can make life its best and what can prevail in moments of difficulty. And I feel really lucky to have been exposed to that man's heart and generosity at that moment, because he didn't have any idea that he was offering me something so much more than a scarf. He was giving me hope that I could carry with me for the rest of my life.
Peter Turnley still works as a photojournalist, and you can see a photo that Peter took while he was covering the Armenian earthquake in 1988 on our website at thestory.org. We also have a link to Peter's most recent book of photographs. It's one that he put together with his twin brother David, and it's called McClellan Street. While you're there at our website, you can also make suggestions for stories, send us ideas for things that you'd like to see covered. We are always open to suggestions from you, and you can reach me most quickly at our website, thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.